You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Craig Drennan. Craig, thanks a lot for being with me today.
Oh, thank you, Brainerd. Happy to be here.
So let's talk about what you're working on now. I want to talk about different aspects of your work, but just to jump right into it, what's happening in the studio now? What are you working on?
Well, it's busy in the studio. I had an exhibition that just came down at Helper in Brooklyn where I was showing drawings and did a performance. And another show coming up at Brooklyn Fireproof that opens in September where it's going to be painting and some photo wall installation pieces. So a lot of stuff coming back from shows, making stuff for new shows. It's busy. It's been a good summer in the studio.
That sounds great. And at the same time, are you teaching or doing other things besides your work this summer?
I teach at Georgia State University in Atlanta, and I had like a early summer class, and I went and taught some workshops out at Anderson Ranch out in Snowmass, Colorado. Had a really great seminar class with some fantastic participants out there where we were looking at, you know, the participants worked through Lyotard's book, The Inhuman. So it was a good time. It's a lot better than I just made it sound.
Well, it does sound interesting. And let's talk a little bit about maybe the premise of some of your work. Just because you were talking about working off a text, too. I know you talk about organizing your studio since 2008 around Shakespeare's Timon of Athens. Could you explain, like, what that means and how that happened?
Oh, absolutely. I'd be happy to. I found out about myself as an adult that I really wasn't an artist who wanted to sort of build a practice around my own subjectivity alone. Like that felt too much like a monument to my own ego in a certain way, and I was less interested in that. So I really found that I preferred to work on a long-term project based around or prompted by something that already exists in the world. And so Timon of Athens acted as that for me, and it's the one play by Shakespeare not produced in his lifetime because it was unfinished or abandoned or whatever the case may be. And I sort of like the emptiness of that, and I thought if I can start using that as a prompt, then it's something that exists in the world where I can meet the audience halfway. Like, everyone's heard of Shakespeare, but maybe not, you know, that particular play. And I'm learning about it as well. So that was much more comfortable for me, to have something cultural that's a meeting place for me and the audience can both sort of join. On a practical level, I've been going down the list of characters in the play, and I make an entirely new, distinct, you know, individual body of work for every character in the play. That's the short answer. There's more, of course. But so essentially, I go down the list of characters. The character of mistresses, I'll make something for that. The character of maskers, I'll make something completely different for them. And then whenever I have a show, if and when I have a show, it's like the characters are coming back on stage together.
Well, that's great. It's really kind of a fascinating approach. But go on, because I wanted to talk about all the different imagery you're making for each one, but what
Sure.
were you just about to say?
Well, all I was going to add is that it's kind of, you know, it's, in some ways, I mean, I feel it's very contemporary and of the moment. It certainly suits me. But it's an old way of working, you know, like to build an imaginative universe, you know, like in the old days. I mean, that's what, you know, going back to Giotto for painting, you had a text that you were prompted to make work, you know, through or for.
That's interesting. Even the old, old painter Piero della Francesca would use like the same actors, so to speak, over and over and
over. Absolutely. And I mean, I'm really fascinated by people like, you know, Eleanor Anton, who to my mind is really undervalued by the art world, the way she goes from, you know, character to character throughout her creative life, and Matthew Barney as well. I mean, I think that's what's interesting about Barney's work is this imaginative universe filled with these characters that he can go to again and again.
So let's talk about, I mean, the universe that you created. I mean, and on one hand, I mean, just to talk about how you jumped into making the first, the art that represented the first characters.
Yeah.
I mean, in one way, you have, you're not working in a particular meeting, so you can kind of do anything as you approach these characters, or do you have parameters on how what you're going to make for them, or what will be represented?
No, that's a good question. I think that I started off the project definitely with my history and skill set within painting. So I think in some ways, even if I wanted to deny it, I think, you know, coming at it through painting is definitely a part of it. And every character probably sets up a different relationship between painting and the rest of the world. For instance, with Old Athenians, which I'm working on right now, it's, you know, a JPEG of Udo Kier as Dracula printed on a canvas in combination with a monochrome painted directly on the wall in latex. In other characters, such as the Maskers, it's paint made to look like, you know, a dessert applied directly to a photograph. You know, and other characters, the mistress's character, it'll be a painting derived from a JPEG placed over top of a minimalist black line painted directly onto the wall, you know, and things like that. So I do set up, like, different conditions for every character, but the whole project is not planned out in advance. And I always like to tell people that because people think that I'm much more... how can I say it? That I'm determining things in advance, when in fact I'm not. Like it really is intuitive, like moving from character to character. There's no plan of action. I started with the lesser characters in the play, but that was just because I thought if I messed up, you know, it's all right. I could spare one of them.
You know? Right.
So I'm about 10 characters in.
And how many characters are there?
Well, and even that should be a very easy question to answer, but it depends on how you divide them up. And, you know, it's Flattering Lords can be one character, or it could be, you know, five or six different individual names and so on. So, again, like, I like how muddled all of this is, because that seems like... you know, that seems like a good platform, this sort of unstable platform to start making work, where it's just this play that nobody's heard of that seems like it was poorly made by one of the great writers of the Western canon. And even within the characters, it seems like I have to make a lot of just arbitrary decisions about what to do next. All of that might drive some people crazy, but to me, like, that sounds great.
Well, to me, it's something comforting also, and maybe somehow just generally within artistic practice, to know that someone like Shakespeare is fallible and did work that was considered poor, bad, or problematic.
Oh, absolutely. And I think there's a great, God, I remember a great line by the critic Peter Sheldahl, like from way back in the day, where he said, even Shakespeare had Monday mornings. I'm sorry, even Rembrandt had Monday morning, but Shakespeare had Monday mornings too.
It's great. So you must, I mean, in a way, this project that, I mean, now began in 2008 and is ongoing, is also kind of like an ongoing way of studying this text, or this, you have a relationship that's, as I see it, and just correct me if I'm wrong, that's kind of intimate and very involved with this particular play and these characters. You're living with them, you're kind of working with them, as you're saying, they're becoming part of your universe. What's happening in that play? I mean, I don't want to be too broad with this, but it seems to me that you're like living with this text for years, and as much as I tried to read about the text before this, and they were talking about what the problem plays of Shakespeare's are with this kind of variety of things happening in them. Have you had any insights into the text, is what I'm saying, and what's it like to be living and working with that text for,
years now? You're exactly right, and I'm not even halfway. And so that also, I think, sort of shocks people because, you know, in like every year things seem to be, or people are the art world seems to valorize immediacy in some way, and speed and quickness and so forth. And so to just even say out loud to someone, I've been working on something for 8 years, I'll probably work on it for another 10 or 12 years. Like, you see their jaws drop. They're like, what? But to me, that doesn't seem strange. Like, you're going to do your work anyway. I just have organized it around this structure. So, I mean, it's not strange to me, but people say, oh, don't you get bored? And I was like, you know, I'm not, I mean, it's not boring. I can do whatever I want, as you quickly figured out. To paraphrase Walt Whitman, I contain one multitude, you know.
Right.
But whenever I'm doing a new, thanks for laughing at that. Whenever I'm doing a new character, I'll reread the play again and just to remind me what that character does, and then I'll pull contemporary associations for each character. But you're right. Like, I had a year and a half, or maybe a little more, where I was working on a character called Several Servants, and they don't even have individual names, but they just sort of come and go. And so I try to think of, you know, servitude and, you know, all the service industry jobs I've had over the years, and so forth. And so it is true. And I've started working with a character poet recently who has the first lines in the play where he just says hello and, like, introduces everybody. It basically just comes out on stage and just starts saying hello. And I thought, you know, what a kind of a nice gesture that is. Just like a friendly greeting without any other agenda or affect or whatever. So to me, all that's interesting. And I will say, one of the issues I had when I started this project, because when I started it, I didn't know, like, is this a good idea? Is this, like, the worst thing I've ever done? And I had to decide, do I want to reveal to the world that I'm using, that this play is a prompt for me? And there are friends of mine, like really smart, far more successful art world folks who I'm friends with, who would say things like, maybe you ought to hold that back. Maybe you shouldn't reveal it. Or maybe you should work on, get the whole thing done, and then do your reveal at the end after 10 years. And I decided not to do that, you know, for a couple reasons. One is I really do believe in the test drive, like taking the work out and taking it into the world and just seeing if it can survive or not. Like, I really depend on that as an artist. And the other part, the reason I decided, you know what, I am going to go ahead and reveal that this play is prompting me, is because I think it lifts a burden from the viewers. Because if I don't reveal what my prompt and what the structure is, then people come to the show and they seem like the big obstacle is the heterogeneity. Like, why are these figures with smiling faces over here called servants? Why are these basketball paintings called poet? You know, why are these vampires called Old Athenian? And the heterogeneity is an obstacle, I think. And so as soon as I say, all I have to say is, oh, it's based on a play by Shakespeare, you just see the burden being lifted, and it doesn't add any understanding. Don't get me wrong. Like, they don't understand the work any better or anything like
right.
that.
Right. Well, they get involved in it in a different way, though. I mean,
exactly.
That seems helpful.
Oh, no, absolutely. And it seems, you know, I know this is on the radio, so I shouldn't say anything too provocative, but on the one hand, like, I don't want to be that cliche of the painter sort of leaking out clues. Like, you know, like, well, whoever, I'm not going to name anybody, but I could, but I won't. But I didn't want to it to seem mysterious or as if I had some secret code that you had to unlock. I want to just be very direct, you know, and just be open and either live or die that way. That seemed better to me.
I like that. And what was the reaction of people, or how has it been over the years? And I guess friends seeing this work evolve, but also others who are seeing it for the first time. Is there a typical reaction or a reaction that,
well, I tell you, I think that maybe, you know, I know your work and practice a little bit, so I think maybe you might understand this or relate to it. But I always had a small following who was really loyal and sort of understood what was happening right away. Just like the people who like Picabia or Guy de Quinte or like other artists who's, you know, his work maybe, you know, it takes a second, you know, or it's not for everyone. It, you know, you have to have sort of a taste for it. And I think I always had those people on my side, like right away. But I think as it's grown, I think it's become broader, or people, I think, are willing to maybe trust me more. I think the trust is an important part. So it's like, all right, this is what he does. He's not trying to trick us. We've seen a trajectory of, you know, about 8 or 10 different characters already. And it seems like, you know, it seems like a lot of effort is put towards the physical fact of the object in the space, which I believe in. Like, I don't, like, you don't have to know anything to have a relationship with the work. You can just walk in and see it and say, oh, okay, this piece is called Flattering Lords. And it's, you know, this image of daisies. And you think, wow, like I'm seduced by it. And, but I don't need to understand fully what Flattering Lords means necessarily. There's something about that, it's fine. I'm totally fine with. I think when people walk through the Louvre, let's say, and you look to the left and you see a big history painting from the 18th or 19th century, I think that people will be seduced by the physical object without having to know the entire story of, you know, the surrender of Cornwallis or Christ in the House of Levi or whatever it might be. I've tried to think of a couple examples there, and I did a terrible job.
No, that's fine. those are pretty obscure. I like that.
But you know what I'm saying? It's like through many people's experience of art, I think there's not that pressure of the immediate understanding the way people want to understand a one-panel cartoon or a TV commercial, you know? And so I guess it's that sort of slower read that's more interesting to me.
So that's what I'm interested too, in that slower read as you're doing it, because, okay, I mean, now we're talking about how, you know, the objects and how the audience and you relate to and create the objects, but then there's this text that you're using, which is, you know, written by, you know, maybe arguably one of the greatest writers that ever lived and has all this kind of innuendo and complexity in it. And to relate it to something that I've done in my own work, I years ago I spent a year hand transcribing the Book of Job, right, with a seagull feather. It was this artistic project. But aside from what the whole project meant, I was living with a text for over a year, and
yeah.
It was kind of like studying a text in a way that I didn't expect to. You know, I was living
Absolutely.
With a character. I was asking questions about them. So here you are, you're living with this text and kind of investigating it for several years now. Is that, I'm kind of wondering what's happening there, and it may not have anything to do with your art directly, but kind of like a Shakespeare scholar, you're just sitting and living with this text and exploring it, and though you're an artist, it's the same kind of thing. You're kind of researching it endlessly, pulling things from it. What do you think about this text, and is it changing the way you're kind of just looking at life, or is that too broad a question?
No, it is, but it's a great question. It's one that I didn't think about in the first couple of years. I will be honest. Like that, I was just sort of so excited by having this thing and just seeing what I can do with it that it didn't dawn on me or didn't occur to me. Just what you're talking about, like constantly being marinated in a way in this text from the early 1600s. And what I can say is I like, it's become more interesting to me, and maybe it's revealed itself over time, but the fact that it's one of the greatest, you know, writers of the Western canon, and his one piece that has difficulty being canonized. And that's the part that I think now I realize that probably was the most attractive part of it, because I think in some ways I thought maybe that was a reflection of me, you know, sort of knowledgeable of the canon, close to the canon, but not really
fitting into the canon, you know, like always being this sort of clunky kind of, I don't want to say outsider necessarily, but just having this this play that clearly has hilarious lines in it. There's some very funny insults, especially in the play.
Well, that's what I meant too. So that's part of what you're getting into that no one else is going to really see. So
absolutely.
Sorry to interrupt, but there's also humor picking up that sounds wonderful. In terms of insults, I mean, again, I don't know anything about that text, so it's fascinating for me to hear about that. The insults and the humor is coming out a lot?
Oh, no, absolutely. And I think, you know, they're just, like, they're hilarious moments. And it's probably just simply unfinished, like, simple as that. Like, it may not be any more complicated than that. But, yeah, there's this kind of smoldering kind of anger that's in it. I mean, it's a very misanthropic kind of play, but within that, it's very funny, and it has, I think, some of the best, meanest insults anywhere. You know, and Shakespeare is like really great at that. And so, this idea of having this kind of smoldering kind of background music of the misanthrope. I'm revealing way too much about myself now, but to have that sort of lightened by humor. In this sort of funny way, like that's interesting to me. I don't know that every one of my pieces has that in it, but I think that I think maybe sometimes it does.
I like that. I like that a lot. And the future of this, so you're continuing to make this, we'll continue to have shows that are iterations of, as I understand it, you know, the play itself, and as you get deeper into it, is there a projection for how long this may run, another 10 years or more? Or how do you see the future of this?
I think probably it'll be 10 years because I have no set number of how many pieces I make for each character. I just base it on an intuition. And I give myself the option to pull characters back in after I've already sort of worked with them. So I think it's at least 10 years. It could be more. And that's interesting to me. Like if I said like it's going to end, you know, New Year's Eve on 2020, like that, I don't know, that wouldn't be as interesting to me. I take great solace in not knowing, which sounds funny, but I do. And for each new character, I give myself some new problem that I've never, even just technically, even if it's a technical problem, like things I've never done before that I have to learn. And so there's a constant learning aspect to it. That I respond to that. And so some of the performances, there's one character in the play named Apamantus who's described as a churlish philosopher. And for that one, because he uses his wit in such a devastating way in public throughout the play, I thought that should be performance. And so that's where I started working on these papier-mâché heads that I would wear out there for these public performances. And that certainly is not my comfort zone. Like, it was way out of my comfort zone. And I wanted to play a musical instrument, so I had to learn that. I had to learn, you know, like, just how to do papier-mâché, how to play a musical instrument. And then the end result are these painted papier-mâché heads that look sort of like me, mounted on the wall as a very weird, eccentric form of painting, just acrylic on papier-mâché heads. And I wouldn't have come to that if not for this, you know, this sort of system I've set up for myself. Like, I wouldn't have given myself that problem to solve, and I wouldn't have made a resolution that would be so unexpected and so different than anything I would have imagined. And that's the part that's, that's what makes it fulfilling to me, and that's what makes it exciting for me to get into the studio is to sort of force myself to do something that I never would think of. There's it's accepted that painters can, if they want, they can go out and focus on one spot in nature. You know, Cézanne can look at Mont Saint-Victoire for years, and that's acceptable. For me, I think I'm just looking at one little spot in culture. which is this play that was produced. So it's not a natural thing, it's a cultural thing, but I'm just staring at it every day, and in a sense, just the way Cézanne was looking at Mont Saint-Victoire, and it's prompting me to, you know, to make work. So it's not complicated for me. In fact, it's like, it's extremely simple. Like every day I go, and people who know me and will sort of confirm my simplicity, but that's the way I look at it. I'm just looking at one spot in culture over a long period of time and, you know, seeing what formal, conceptual, technical decisions it prompts me to make.
Craig, that's really exciting, and I want to thank you for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure.
Oh, thank you very much, Brainerd.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.